Hi everyone, you're listening to the Singapore Noodles podcast, where we believe in a Singapore in which its people are proud of the rich and diverse food culture that we have and play an active role in keeping our food heritage alive. I'm your host, Pamelia Chia, and today I'm joined by researcher and author of The Food of Singapore Malays, Keir Johari. Born and raised in Kampong Glam, Singapore's Muslim quarter dating back to 1819, Keir's interest in his cultural identity was sparked when he left Singapore for university in California. He says, being away from family and home, you tend to examine and reflect on who you are. I yearn to read in Malay, to taste the food of home, and to rediscover my roots. In 2010, he started doing heritage trails in Kampong Glam, as he describes that it wasn't just his childhood home. It was also, once upon a time, a royal enclave and the cradle of Malay culture in Singapore. Becoming aware of the lack of documentation of Malay cuisine and its relationship with Malay culture, he spent 10 years writing The Food of Singapore Malays. The result is a landmark book that celebrates not just the cuisine of the Malays, but also the people and culture of the Malay archipelago. So I think before we begin, let's talk a little bit about who are the Malays, because I think a lot of people are very confused about how are they a distinct group from the Indonesians. So can you tell me a little bit about that?
So it all depends on how we want to define Malay. Are we defining Malay based, say, on sort of a anthropological sort of definition? Are we looking at Malay as a cultural group? Are we looking at Malay as defined, say, by a constitution like in Malaysia? Yeah. So, you know, for the purpose of my book, because the title is the book, The Food of Singapore Malays, so I have to start by defining what is my working definition? What is a Malay? So there are two ways of looking at it, right? We can look at Malays and like one of the many, many, many subgroups in the archipelago. There's the Malay, the subgroup, and also Malay, the umbrella term. That, you know, that's why we have the Malay archipelago. Yeah. So in my book, I am looking at Malay. Looking at the larger definition of Malay. You know, people kind of having the same sort of, you know, same language, the same kind of food pattern, having the same sort of a way of dressing up. I'm looking at that overarching definition of the Malay world.
Yeah. Yes. So how did your interest in Malay food culture begin? Were you always interested in it?
Well, you know, I was born and raised in Kampong Glam. And as you know, Kampong Glam is the sort of the epicenter, the urban cosmopolitan setting for sort of a Singapore Malay. You know, that's always been the epicenter. And in many ways, Singapore, you know, is like the New York of the Nusantara of the Malay world, yeah? Judging by, you know, it's the publication world, yeah? All the publishing houses, the printing houses, and Singapore was also the disembarkation point, yeah? The embarkation and disembarkation point of the Hajj. So you could be from Quanzhou, China, you could be from Mindanao, or you could be from Java. It's always been Singapore as the place that you go to before you head on to the Red Sea for your Hajj. So that's the other play, the role that Singapore played. And of course, later on, you know, Singapore was instrumental in the sort of the performing arts, in as a performing arts center in the region, whether it is acting, I mean, the movies, or whether it's in recording. You know, we know that, for example, HMV, you know, very early on, had us in a studio in Singapore and recording in Malay. Being in Singapore, being in that, growing up in Kampong Glam, you know, you'll be exposed to so many things. You're exposed to the pluralism that you experience every day, the variety of food and all the various arteries of food preparation and fruit, you know, incubation, so to speak. So I feel that this has to be documented. Yeah, I feel that there is also, if we look at, you know, I live in the States for 12 years. I live in the Bay Area, and we know the Bay Area is very, very diverse. And I started the first culinary club in Silicon Valley. It's not about free makan, but it's about learning other cultures. What better way for young people to learn about other cultures than through food? Maybe Vietnamese or Ethiopian or Greek. So, and then, of course, naturally, the student would ask me, being the person in charge of the club, you are a Malay. What's Malay food? What makes Malay food? What's so Malay about Malay food, right? All questions like that. But because you live in sort of a place like the Bay Area, you can have access to, let's say, University of Berkeley Southeast Asian Library collection, and you can walk into a secondhand bookstore and pick up something, by Winstead or Wilkinson. Things that, so because I'm acutely aware there is a dearth on Malay gastronomy, like a dedicated book. We don't have that. Mm. But what we have are nuggets embedded in travelogues, in Hikayat, in the British administrator's report. So it's all through this material that I managed to amass through the secondhand bookstores in Berkeley and put together. And of course, and that's not enough. That's only one part of, collecting material in order to write something. Like in this case, with writing about Malay food, I feel there's a need to do more research, to dig out more books, buy books, to interview, to get empirical evidence from, old people while they're still around.
So you talked about the lack of documentation of Malay gastronomy. So what do you think accounts for this?
Well, I think, Malay culture is pretty much an oral culture. Mm. Whatever, for example, a great-grandmother knows how to make the best dodol, it's not recorded, it's passed down, you see. It's the practical experience. Yeah. And with time, you internalize it. So there's no really solid documentation. And then here comes the British, colonial kind of masters, and they're observing, they're watching what people were eating, how they were prepping, looking at techniques, looking at all the various, kitchen implements and tools, and they recorded it. So today, a researcher like myself, we benefited from that.
So you took about 10 years to write this entire book. So what do you think are the most distinctive traits of Singaporean Malay food that you have discovered?
We tend to think that, especially in today's context, we talk about, oh, that's Malaysian, or this is Singapore, that's Indonesia, or this distinctively Singapore. But is it really distinct? On one hand, I think there's so much in common. And we all know, in 1824, the entire Malay world was carve out, 1824, between the Dutch, and the British, and that created two different sphere of influences. Yeah. So it's pretty much the same, you're talking about the same environment, the same flora and fauna, the same understanding, right? The same ancestors, if you sort of never left the region. But with time, maybe we were to apply the modern day sort of nation state, lenses, yes, we tend to say, oh yeah, what is Singapore food? What is Malaysian food? Well, there are. Yeah, there are some sort of distinction. It's just like you're traveling, in Italy, right? There's a common Italian sort of a cuisine. But we also know there are regional specialities. Yeah? You go to Umbria, there's something different from Venezia. So they are different. So likewise in Singapore, well, there are a lot of things in common, but we, as a young nation, as a very sort of a very cosmopolitan, very urban, having we have the affluence, the accessibility to food. And if you were to look, for example, if you look at a port muster report of 1820, the food produced that made its way to Singapore as a collecting and a distribution point, we'd be amazed at the variety. So this is exactly the setting that the people in Singapore, right, and Singapore Malays in particular, since we're talking about Singapore Malays, that have absorbed these ingredients and make it their own.
Mm. What are some of these dishes?
A good example, that I always use is mee siam. Yeah? With a name like mee siam, could that be from Thailand because it's siam? Well, mee siam, of course, the vermicelli, the 1820, I don't know we have how many pickles. I have to look at the numbers of the dry, because it travels well. It's dry noodle that made its way to the ports of Singapore. So we've already been exposed to mee siam, the noodle, not mee siam, the dish. But with time, people we've been bringing with them, their prior knowledge, experimenting. And after many generations, we get the mee siam that we have today.
Yeah, that's true. So you were talking about how Singapore now is really cosmopolitan and really modern. And I was reading an article about foraging that you wrote. So how do you think urbanization and globalization has had an impact on Malay food in Singapore.
Right. So our understanding of food is pretty much based on our surrounding. We eat what is available. Mm. So may it be your front yard, you know, where you at low tide, you'd be able to forage for shellfish. Or, you know, given that we are maritime people, you know, we are sort of, we have the intimate knowledge, you know, of in the fishing, right? What fish? The fish seasoned, where to get what fish, what do you do with excess fish, all the varieties of dishes that you could create out of fish. Yeah. So that has changed, right? And we all know that, you know, fishermen now live in flats. Well, or at least descendants of fishermen, they live in flats today. And also, you know, in the past, people, you know, really before the advent of markets, people, you know, even with markets around, certain things are grown in the wild or semi-cultivated. So you leave the comfort of your home to forage. Indeed, there's one other thing that I want to share with you, Pamelia. We look at the word ingredient. The word ingredient in Malay is ramuan. Mm-hmm. So regardless of what you're preparing, and the ingredient is that's ramuan. But ramuan comes from the word ramu. Mm-hmm. And ramu means forage. So ramuan in the ingredient is what is that which has been foraged.
Oh, that's so fascinating. I never knew that.
Yeah.
So there's this huge sense of eating from your environment, right? Like this whole concept of eating ulam that has been, I feel, a bit lost through the years. Do you feel the same?
Absolutely. And indeed, if you were to look at the root word of ulam, it's an Austronesian term. Let's take a look at the sort of, you know, let's take a look at like in the northern extension of the Malay world, and that's the what is today the Philippines, we call the Philippines. The main dish that to go with the rice is called ulam.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah. So the ulam has always been central. If you look at the Malay diet, historically, has always been past what we call today, very fancy, in a stylish name, we call it pescatarian.
Yeah.
The Malays have always been pescatarian. I mean, you know, we're maritime people, right? You know, we so it's always been fish. You know, your daily food is fish and greens. And there's so many ways of working with greens. So you could get your greens from the wild, yeah? You know, in from the forest or secondary forest. Or you can get your greens if you grow in your front yard or backyard. What can you do with all the greens? You know, you could make your ulam, yeah? Ulam typically refers to raw, something that's raw. You can make your krabu, that's your salad, yeah? You can make your gulai lemak if you cooked it in a broth of coconut milk. You can make it a consomme, you know, if you do it in like it's a clear you know, vegetable soup. You can have a certain acidity in it, and it becomes sayur asam. You could blanch it. You know, you could saute it. You could pickle your greens when you have excess. You could wrap it up and bake, and becomes your pies. You can wrap it up and steam, becomes your boto-boto. And you can use it for garnishing. Of course, your flavoring as well, of course. You know, if you want a certain aroma, a certain flavor. So there's so much to do. Hence, that was the impetus for me to include not only a lease of Flora Malaysiana in the glossary of my book, but also another lease of all the ulams. And many of them have been forgotten because, to answer your question, you know, we have lost that surrounding. But that said, I am heartened by this renewed interest among young people, you know, activists from, say, the Nature Society, to want to start planting again, right? In, you know, HDB, you know, estates, there are plots, people are planting their own small vegetable garden, their herbal garden, people are growing in pots in the HDB corridors. People are trying to find out where could we possibly forage, right? Of course, you have to begin by, you know, understand to be able to identify, to be able to understand the nomenclature.
Yeah, I really love that. There is this school in Malaysia called the Ulam School. I'm not sure if you have heard of them, but they are doing like fantastic work to document all of the regional produce because there are quite a lot of overlaps between every country, right? Like in Vietnam, in Thailand.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that you probably want to take a look. One of my hopes, now that the book is out, is to have a conversation and ultimately work on codifying the Southeast Asian food.
Yeah, and I feel that you know, Malay food culture is so artisanal, but people don't recognize that. I think a while ago, I was having a chat with one of my friends, Harrell. His parents were actually tempeh makers in Singapore. His grandparents actually used the simple leaves to ferment and to get the spores, the culture for making tempeh. It was so fascinating. I was like, why is no one actually, you know, talking about these kind of things more often?
You're right. You know, pretty much artisanal, you know, it's home-based. People have sort of this a tested understanding of how to prepare, how to preserve. Yes, very much artisanal. And by extension, when we look at our understanding of Malay food, it's typically based on sort of narrow window, and that is the hawker center. Mm. So you need to, you know, when you get a chance to visit Malay homes, and you know, or you visit your Malay neighbors, Malay friends, and that is where you get to see things that you don't normally experience. If our first encounter of Malay food is the food center, the food center has its role. The food center plays an important role indeed, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But if our first encounter is that sort of a limited, so, you know, say a spread, and that tends to be our reference point. But if we get a chance to say, hang out with your friends and neighbors and travel the region. Mm. The food of Singapore, you know, really pretty much is a sort of almost representative of the food of the region, given Singapore and the Malay mix, all the various ethnic groups.
Yeah.
So that will sort of form how not just individuals look at Malay food, but the media itself, how we look at Malay food. I think reading and traveling helps to inform. And with that, you know, we understand the diversity and the beauty and look at Malay food as something that's really based on what I shared with you earlier about the pescatarian, is a very healthy diet. Well, you know, any food you eat in excess, you know, it's bad, right? Regardless of what's your background, and ethnicity or geography, any food that you eat in excess is bad. But you look at Malay diet, yeah, it's very much about going back to nature. It's about connecting with your surrounding.
Mm.
Yeah. So and I think the media would be helpful for the media to understand that, you know, when we consume, you know, we enjoy Malay food, we are enjoying the region.
Do you think that there are differences in the way that Singaporeans perceive Malay food and Peranakan food? I was seeing debates on the Nasi Ambeng incident with Violet Un, right? And I had a lot of Malay friends who were talking about how there is not enough acknowledgement when it comes to Malay cuisine as being kind of like a mother cuisine to Peranakan cuisine. So I was wondering what you thought about that.
This is not a very... easy topic to talk about, but I think sometimes something that's uncomfortable in a situation, you know, it's good to have a conversation because it will foster growth.
Mm.
Yeah. So let's talk about this. Let's take a look at the term Peranakan.
Mm.
Yeah. What is Peranakan? So Peranakan, the concept of Peranakan, Peranakan is a Malay word created by the Malays for a Malay concept. So in a region whereby we are sort of between two major civilizations, Chinese and Indian civilization, and later on we experienced in the exchange Islamicus, whereby you know, we have people from, you know, the Near East and Middle East made its way to our part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It not only brought religion, but it brought a way of life, a different way of eating as well. Yeah. And then we have the Europeans coming our way in search of spice, and this being the cradle of spices. Yeah. So imagine the confluence of all these people, right, during the age of trade. So all this men travel, not women. Many of these men ended up settling with local women. So the mother is a Nusantara mother. Social learning theory tells us it's always the mother, right? You know, what you wear, what, how you talk, your speech, what you wear, especially the girls, because the girls have their mother as a reference point. The boys maybe look up to their father, who might be an Arab, who might be a Dutchman, might be someone from Fujian. It could be a man from Tamil Nadu. But the mother is a local mother. So you eat what your mother cooks. So, and hence, you know, to give rise, to give birth to the Peranakan culture. So it's a very, it, to me, it's a very beautiful concept. It's a very, you know, it's an embracing concept. Instead of looking at you as the other or different, but they recognize that you are a child of the womb. That's what Peranakan means. You are a child of the region through your mother.
That's so poetic.
Yes, yes. It is the original mother. The early maternal roots are here. So that's why the food that we consume is pretty much the same, right? That said, if the father comes from Fujian, you understand how to eat your mushroom. You probably want to have your pork in your rawon to make, become, to babi buah keluar, right? So it's, that sort of thing happens, you see? So that's one aspect. So the Peranakan in Singapore tends to be, people tend to think that it's just Chinese Peranakan. But the reality is that there's a whole spectrum of Peranakan groups.
Like the Indian Peranakans?
Indeed, yes, yes. The Indian Peranakan, the Arab Peranakans, and so on. And like in all hybrid culture, when we travel, I mean, any bona fide foodie who's interested in food, or for hybrid food for that matter, if let's say it's made of A and B, now we are able to unpack what's A and what's B. And sometimes this hybrid community are actually consuming exactly the same as A or exactly the same as B, right? It's not really. So when that happened, as in the case, let me give one example. Let's take a look at Kuih Putri Salat. You know, it's something that's consumed, you know, you travel from Kalimantan all the way to Aceh. You see the same idea of eating srikaya with your glutinous rice. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice sort of, you know, a balance between sweet custard and your sort of savory, you know, sticky rice. So that's been around for a very long time. So the problem is this: when you claim sole authorship, that's problematic. Mm-hmm. See? But if it's understood, let's say, yes, you know, we Peranakans, we eat putri salat, it is Peranakan food. There's no denying about that. Yeah, because the early maternal roots are all this, you know, Nusantara women, everybody knows how to make srikaya with sticky rice. Yeah. But when you market it as a sole, it has a sole authorship, and with no mention, you know, of the root, with no mention of its origin, or without looking around your left and right to see what other people are eating, that can be problematic.
Yeah. And so through the writing of this book, how do you hope to foster a deeper understanding of Singaporeans about Singaporean Malay food? Or how do you hope to overturn some misconceptions that people have about the cuisine?
I have a chapter dedicated to food as medicine. And I began by saying there is an old adage in the Malay world that goes like this. Why eat medicine? Why not eat food that becomes medicine? So that's one of the things that, one of the takeaways I would like people, you know, to get from the book, to look at, you know, the celebration of food as not just for, you know, for sustenance of food, also for that's important in your celebration, but food as a source of good health. So that's one thing, and I hope by looking at this the book, people see the richness. People see the creativity in Malay food. How Malay food is celebrated in songs, in literature, in poetry. Looking at how the Malay attach food to symbolism, to mythology.
So you talked about food from a health standpoint. Do you mean like a more holistic approach to eating, or are you referring to something more specific like jamu and ulam?
Both of them. So it could be food in the form of jamu, or food in the form of ulam. And also your concoction of your, let's say, your broth. So you're making a particular, say, you know, fish broth, let's say. But you know what the ingredient that goes into that, and you know the efficacy and the potency of of the food. And also, one of the things that I included in the book is to know the do's and don'ts, or rather, the classification of food. When you talk about food as medicine, is this food that's the heaty food? Is it a cooling food? Is it a food that, you know, costs, you know, sort of that is caustic? Let's say I have a cut, right? And some foods that I cannot consume, like crustacean, there's some components in the crustacean that will cause the itchiness. Or after labor, right? Some things you just stay away from, you know, because it's not compatible, because you've gone through birth, and you know you're not supposed to consume it because it's detrimental to your well-being, you know, your recovery, you know, as a young mother.
Yeah, I find that very fascinating, because a lot of Asian cultures have such a huge link between food and holistic health, right? I mean, in Chinese cuisine, there's always this like cooling and heaty kind of concept. And in Indian food, there is this huge idea of Ayurveda that governs everything that you eat. So, I mean, we've talked quite at length about your book and about, you know, all these concepts. I would love to find out a little bit more about you as a person. So can you tell me about how you decided that this would be your career or your life's work?
There's something about food. Food has a tendency to connect people, yeah? You know, rather than, you know, sort of, you know, push people apart. And there's so much that I'm sure in food, we see so much that we have in common. And I have this insatiable curiosity about the genealogy of food. So when I travel quite a bit. One of the first places that I would go to, apart from museum, would be markets. Market, as you know, is a place where it provides me a window of the local people, lifestyle, you know, and what people consume. So I've always been fascinated by food, you know, the history behind food, the culture, the traditions that's attached to food. And, you know, growing up also in Gedung Kuning and Kampung Gelam, I see that residence as like a treasure house of recipes, you know, given to me by the family, sort of in a connection with the larger Malay Muslim world. So very early on, I've been exposed. In part, you know, I was a curious kid. And at the same time, I want to not just enjoy, but I have a lot of questions.
And so you started out by asking your parents about, you know, certain parts of the Malay food culture?
Indeed. And mom was also a cooking teacher. So that helps, you know, and growing up in a house with where there are 42 other people, with four kitchens, with so many grandmothers and the aunties, and all the celebration, because there was a matriarch in the house. So I've been exposed to very early on, and you know, you get curious about how do you prepare certain food beyond just simply enjoying and saying, oh, this is delicious. So what goes into the food? Yeah.
So you were always involved in the kitchen and you knew how to prepare certain dishes?
I think I was 9 when I helped my grand aunt, you know, how to fry the serunding, you know, from start to end.
Wow.
You know, over you know, charcoal, you know, stove. And about that time, same time too, I wanted to know how I could bake cupcakes. So I was taught, you know, the very early, just with a bowl and a fork, this whole idea of 1-1-2-2, one egg, one tablespoon of butter, two sugar and three flour. And then, of course, you could, you know, you could embellish it with your chocolate rice or your raisin that you get from the mama shop, you know, you know, next door. I'm very, very fortunate, you know, to have that the experience of, you know, being raised in Kampung Gelam, you know, that within, say, a space of 1 kilometer square, we see different kinds of food being produced. I see this whole area as a creative hub. People were experimenting. So many recipes, new ideas that came out of this place that I call my stomping ground.
And how do you think Kampung Gelam is today compared to how it used to be?
Surprisingly, it has we see a revivalism, I mean, within Kampung Gelam when it comes to F&B. But never in my wildest dream I would imagine there's going to be a great Italian restaurant in my backyard along Kandahar Street. You know, it's always been sort of in the Malay Muslim sort of fair. We get lots of Indian food on Kandahar Street. There's one artery, you know, lined with so many things, you know, from with a whole spread of curry, yogurt in terracotta pots, fried pigeon, chapati, your appam, your paratha. They're all on one street. That's Kandahar Street. Mm. And then we have Bustra Street. That has been dubbed as the incubator for all the kuehs in Singapore. So my reference point when you talk about kueh has always been Bustra Street. And every house have their own specialty, and they're also creating, you know, new recipes that with time becomes sort of heritage food. And then beyond that, you know, we have Jalan Sultan. That is the original home for your mutton chop and your sop tulang.
I love that.
Yeah, and we had in the past, the Kamugalam, we had things like nasi dal, which is really, you know, sort of extinct in Singapore. Imagine.
What is that? Nasi
dal. That lentil? Yeah. So nasi basmati rice cooked with clarified butter, you know, infused with all the spices and speckled with golden lentils. So that's gone, and then we also had mi odong. So it's actually mi odong is a corruption of the udon. So there was a Malay family that used to work with the Japanese, and you know there was one of the speciality people, you know, from Johor would come down to Singapore to experience mi odong, but mi odong is gone now. So we lost that, but at the same time in Kamugalam, it seems to be that is the place for you if you want to open a halal restaurant. We see all the bakeries and there is, you name it, from Wagyu to ramen to Vietnamese pho, to French food, of course, Middle Eastern, all in Kamugalam today. So it's interesting to see how it has again become sort of a halal food hub.
Mm. And how do you think the Malay people's interactions with food have shifted or changed from the time when you were younger to now? I always feel that Malay food has this stereotype of being laborious and time-consuming, and maybe a lot of people might not be cooking it as much as they used to. So how do you perceive this shift?
I think it's happening everywhere, right? Mm. You know, people are, you know, busy with their sort of the daily grind, and people are spending less and less time. We are seeing this, I think, pretty universal, less and less time preparing food. Yes, Malay food tends to be laborious, but again, it is a choice. A choice that you could use your food processor, where you know the machine chops, as opposed to using your batu giling, where you actually pulverize your ingredients. Mm. So it's a choice that, you know, and I think because if people are just, you know, occupied with, you know, sort of daily, you know, sort of work, and yes, people are spending less time. But again, you could find time. I mean, I'm in many ways I'm a purist. I mean, while I love innovation, I want to try out new things, I celebrate bright new ideas. But for certain things, I want to retain that flavor, yeah, that way of cooking.
You were talking about how embedded Malay cuisine or food culture is within nature, right? Within concepts of foraging, of using what you have. So how do you think Singaporeans can adopt that kind of ethos in this modern day and age?
I think, you know how these days, you know, people are also looking into consuming this what's organic. So that's one way. But I think in terms of having the opportunity to space to forage, you know, we are pretty much, we are pretty much limited. Let's put it that way, yeah. But that said, you know, we can still, you know, look at food that's sustainable, celebrate what's in season, to, you know, to not waste any parts of a particular kind of ingredient.
Mm. So true.
Those are things that I think it's within our reach that we could do.
So what are some of your hopes for Singaporean food culture, or what kind of change would you like your book to spark?
First of all, I'd like to see sort of renewed interest among young people about traditional food. I would like to see this fostering of a sense of pride, you know, of one's gastronomic tradition. And to see that there's also this idea of a shared culture within, you know, our nation. There's so much that we share. And to start sort of a conversation, to looking at the richness, you know, of what we have.
Mm. I just cannot fathom how much time and effort has gone into making this book a reality. I can't wait to actually start reading your book. So thank you for what you do, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Pamelia. Thank you for having me.
That wraps up another episode of the Singapore Noodles podcast. You have been listening to K.R. Johari, researcher and author of The Food of Singapore Malays. We now stand at the crossroads where we're witnessing the vanishing of traditional dishes and the gradual erosion of our rich food culture. Now more than ever, it is so important to encourage one another to get back into the kitchen and start cooking food from our heritage. Singapore Noodles is offering a membership dedicated to equipping anyone with everything that they need to start cooking Singaporean food. Visit us at sgpnoodles.com to find out more. Once again, thank you for listening to the Singapore Noodles podcast, where we believe in a Singapore in which its people are proud of the rich and diverse food culture that we have and play an active role in keeping our food heritage alive.